This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. When landlords and their tenants get along, life can be wonderful. That leaky sink or noisy radiator gets fixed, and that rent check comes on time every month. But many landlords have experienced horror stories of trying to get rent payments and having tenants who destroy their property or use it for illegal activity. Likewise, many renters say they've run into trouble with do-nothing landlords who won't fix problems or make good on promises. The love-hate relationship between landlords and tenants is our topic today on Vermont Edition. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you on this. Are you a renter who's had a problem with your landlord, but maybe you weren't sure what rights you had? Or have you learned some valuable lessons about renting that you'd like to share? And landlords, what do you want to know about your rights and responsibilities regarding tenants? You can call us at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. My guests today are Angela Zykowski and Pam Favreau. Angela Zykowski owns the Vermont Apartment Owners Association. That's a trade organization that provides landlords across the state with information and tips to do their jobs better, as well as information on Vermont laws affecting landlords. Pam Favreau is director of Vermont Tenants. It's a nonprofit that helps provide information on renters' rights and their responsibilities. First off, thank you both for being on the program today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Angela Zykowski, I'm going to start with you. What are the basic rights of landlords in Vermont? What should they expect from their tenants once they sign a lease?
Well, I think the important thing to consider or remember is that tenants and landlords actually have pretty similar and aligned interests. So landlords would like the rent to be paid, and they'd like to have their property treated with respect. And conversely, tenants would like to have value, so have a decent place to live. And for the most part, they'd like to be left alone by their landlord.
Pam Favreau, any differences on that, looking at it from the tenant's point of view?
No. I think one of the things that you and your listeners will find interesting today is that Angela and I have really similar views on this, that the goal really is for a peaceful relationship, and we like to teach it as a business relationship, so I completely agree.
Angela Zykowski, your association deals with, I think, 1,000 of the state's landlords. Do you find that most landlords are aware of what their responsibilities are and are pretty up on the laws?
I think there's a very big mix around the state. I would say, for the most part, the folks who are members of our association, and we are a membership-based organization, are up on the laws and the requirements. What we find is landlords who come across our agency or our organization who are referred to us by other places may not be as familiar because they don't have a vehicle to gain that information. So our organization tries to be that supplier of information for landlords.
How about you, Pam Favreau? Do you find that most renters understand what their rights are and where to go for help if they have a problem?
And that's not a mixed bag for us. That's a definite no. We recently launched a new program educating tenants on their responsibilities. In order to create this educational program, we went through 32 years worth of records from Vermont tenants. And consistently across the board, in excess of 75% of our callers had no clue that there were laws that addressed this situation. So,
wow.
No, there's simply, I reiterate what Angela said, there's not a vehicle where people are taught how to be good, responsible tenants or good, responsible landlords. And that's the gap both of our programs are trying to fill.
Right. And to sort of jump back in here, I think there's a lot of fallacies that surround the landlord-tenant population and relationship, things as simple as landlords can't evict tenants in the winter, which is completely not true. It hasn't been true for a very long time in Vermont. But yeah, we still continually hear this that gets passed around as misinformation.
Yeah, I totally agree. In fact, amongst the public presentations we do, almost all of them have like a myth-busting section of the presentation where we say these are the most common myths around renting, and they're all exactly that, myths.
Huh. So Paul from Brattleboro writes in, I'm a tenant in an office building, and I've had a lot of conflict with my landlord. He's never brought legal action against me, but he's threatened eviction several times, and I've had to hire a lawyer to defend myself against these threats. I'm looking for a new office now, but this whole relationship has cost me substantial amounts of money. Can I somehow recover my legal fees, either now or more comfortably when I leave the office? Can I sue in small claims court or somewhere else? Who might be able to...
This is Angela. I don't mind jumping in. I'm
an
attorney. Hesitating to give legal advice over the radio, but a commercial tenancy in Vermont is substantially different and regulated substantially different than a residential rental in Vermont. In a commercial tenancy, the lease is completely going to govern that relationship. So any of the rights and responsibilities are going to come from the lease agreement itself. So if Paul would need to take a look at whatever his lease agreement said, and that's going to tell him everything he needs to know. There's not a statutory framework that overlays commercial rentals in the state of Vermont.
Interesting. 1-800-639-2211 is the number to call. Maybe you have a question about renting issues, or maybe you're a landlord with some questions. Now is your chance to join in the conversation here on Vermont Edition. Let's go to the phone lines now. Let's take a call from New Haven. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having the chance to put this program together. I had rented my home for a period of 3 years, and... we had arranged that when they were moving out, that we'd have a walkthrough, and that did not happen. And another part of it was it took me quite a while between August and Labor Day, the holiday over Labor Day weekend, to gather all of the things that I had to do to remedy the condition that the house was in. So I did not actually submit to them a deduction from the security deposit within the 14 days. So their position now is that they're not taking any responsibility. They want the full deposit back. And they presented, part of the law, which says if I willfully withheld the deposit, then they're entitled to the deposit plus the times two amount, so double the deposit, and for my to be paying their attorney's fees. In consultation with an attorney, his recommendation was that I could go ahead and give them back the deposit, not agreeing that it releases them, but then now I would have to consider taking them to court for damages, so I would be released of the 14-day issue that they would want to press against me, and then go ahead and see if they would say, all right, we realize this could be a real problem. And if they didn't, then now I could then take them to court. And the law says that they would pay my attorney's fees.
I was going to say, John, let me throw that to Angela Zakowski to get her take on it.
Does actually sound accurate. Unfortunately, the security deposit deadline is one of the few very, very hard deadlines for landlords. Notice to the tenants as to what's happening with their deposit is required to be sent within 14 days of the tenant vacating or the landlord discovering that the tenant has vacated. As most landlords or anybody who does renovations or repairs on property know, you're not going to get all of the work done during those 14 days. The law does allow you to use estimates, sort of your best guess as to what it's going to cost, but the tenant is entitled to their deposit back if you miss that deadline. However, you can pursue them for damages in small claims court.
Interesting. Joya in Bath, New Hampshire wrote in, I live in New Hampshire and our lease ends at the end of February. Our landlord agreed to wait until his return from Bermuda to finalize the lease for next year. We'd asked for a deduction due to the utilities being higher than his estimate. He changed his mind and asked us to move out at the end of February. There's a leak in the chimney liner that is leaking water into the cellar. What should we do? I was in a recent car accident and my husband is disabled. We can't move out just now. Pam Favreau, what would you recommend that Joy and Bath, New Hampshire do?
Okay. First of all, I want to clarify a situation. And we're called Vermont Tenants for a reason. And what I think a lot of people don't realize is We're talking about state statutes. So these are Vermont state statutes. New Hampshire has a different set of statutes looking at tenants' rights and responsibilities. I'm not an expert in New Hampshire's, but almost across the board in any state, if you're having problems in terms of the condition of your rental unit, here in Vermont it's called the warranty of habitability, that there is always within your town a way to access an inspector who generally works for the state or the town that can go in, check to see if you're in compliance with health or fire safety code, and then basically order the landlord to repair the situation. So I would suggest to the caller that she call her city or town clerk's office and ask if they have a health officer or a board of health. And that would probably help get it resolved in terms of the repair needs. In terms of him asking her to leave, it's also a pretty consistent across the board that generally eviction is a legal process. And I happen to know it is in New Hampshire as well. And so one of the terms we use a lot when we're talking with tenants is it's really about language that you use. And in order to try to get it across for a few years now, we've been really saying in this state, landlords do not evict tenants. Judges evict tenants. And landlords start that process by sending a termination of tenancy notice. And our laws really outline clearly how much time of notice, the reasons, you know, and what should be in that notice. And if the tenant then doesn't vacate voluntarily, then a court eviction process begins. So she's going to have the same right to that process that she would, you know, if she were here in Vermont.
Angela Zakowski, do you think overall Vermont statutes tend to favor one group or the other? I've often heard that renters, the laws, at least in Vermont, are weighted a little bit more to protect renters. Would you agree with that, or do you think it's pretty fairly laid out?
I think that Vermont is a consumer protection state, which means that Vermont does and crafts its laws to protect consumer. And in this instance, the consumer is the tenant. So there are a lot of protections in the law for tenants. But if landlords are familiar with the system and know how to navigate through that system, it is navigable. It's not something that is so arcane that landlords can't manage their properties. They can't run their properties. They can't get tenants out. Does the process take some time? Yes. Do you have to know what you're doing? Yes. Do you need to make sure you follow the rules? Yes. But there are a lot of protections inherent in the law for tenants.
Robert sent us this question. What is a landlord's recourse if the lease states that only one person's name is in the lease or only, let me take this again. What is a landlord's recourse if the lease states that only the persons named in the lease are allowed to reside at that property, but there's an additional person living there without the landlord's approval? I have to think that comes up a lot. Angela Zakowski, what can a landlord do in this situation?
It does come up frequently. I think there's a couple of things a landlord can do. The first thing is to attempt to talk to their tenants and have open lines of communication and explain to them that others living at the property is not allowed under the lease. Sometimes tenants don't think about it. They don't consider it. Their buddy asks them if they can move in and stay with them for a while. And it doesn't cross their mind that it's not something that's allowed under the lease. So talking to your tenants is a good first course of action. If you have a situation where the tenant either doesn't care or isn't going to abide by the rules of the lease, the landlord has recourse by sending what's called a notice of termination for breach of lease, which is there's unauthorized occupants living in the unit.
Pam Favreau, does that come up with your organization where people are surprised by that if they have a friend living with them for a while? I'm imagining in Burlington when there are a lot of college students.
Yeah, and statewide. I mean, we are a statewide program, and yeah, we get a lot of calls from that same situation. And excuse me, one of the things that really brings to mind for me is kind of dovetailing on that are instances and situations where the tenant is saying this is a guest. And the landlord is trying to say, well, you can't have guests. And there's this whole kind of middle muddy piece in there of, is this a guest or is this person actually living with you when you're in violation of the lease? And what we usually do in terms of educating tenants is take it down to a very simple does the person staying with you have their own residence? And if they have their own residence, chances are what you have there is a guest. You know, there are always little quirks in the story. But what a lot of tenants don't realize is that a friend gets into trouble and they say, yeah, come stay with me until you get back on your feet. Well, you've made an open offer for them to live there completely as a full-time residence. So you now not only have violated your lease, but you yourself have become their landlord. And you are now subject to all the same laws if you want them to leave. So, yeah, we find many, many tenants get into trouble doing this and not really understanding, you know, where the law comes in and their responsibility in their lease contract.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the relationship between landlords and renters today. We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can call us at 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. My guests today are Angela Zykowski and Pam Favreau. Angela Zykowski owns the Vermont Apartment Owners Association. Pam Favreau is director of Vermont Tenants. It's a nonprofit that helps provide information on renters' rights and responsibilities. We'll get to more of your calls, and we'll talk with a Champlain College student who started a new website to make information about landlords and apartments in the Burlington area more transparent. That's ahead on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. Depending on where you live in Vermont, apartments can be easier or harder to find. In the Burlington area, with so many college students vying for housing, there simply aren't enough apartments to meet demand. It's the kind of situation that puts renters at a big disadvantage. Champlain College student Alex Sturgis decided to do something about that, and this year she launched BVTenants.com. It's a website aimed at giving tenants more power in Burlington's competitive apartment marketplace. Alex Sturgis joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Nina. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So what pushed you to create this website?
Well, I was walking up the hill to campus, and I was just sort of pondering the whole process of getting an apartment in Burlington. And really, you have to, in some cases, provide references and a credit check, and sometimes even a cosigner. The tenants have to put forth so much, and really there wasn't any way for the tenant to find information about the landlord, and they didn't really have to put any information about themselves and their history forward. And so I wanted to make it easier for people to learn how to advocate for themselves and get a little bit of transparency.
So how can renters use your site? What sorts of information and content is available?
Well, there's some different ways that we found that people are using the site. The first is really to bridge the gap between the young renting population of Burlington, which is mostly students, and the resources that are available to them. A lot of young people just don't know that they have these resources and these rights. And so even though code enforcement and Vermont Tenants are a Google search away, sometimes they just aren't aware of their existence. And so by going on a site, they can say, oh, there are a couple things that I can use if I get into some trouble. The second way is just transparency and really helping people see all the information and get a little bit of a clearer picture. And the third is I've heard a lot of landlords tell me that they have used the site in order to learn how to better serve their tenants. You know, someone remarked on a review once that a good landlord is there when you need him and not there when you don't, which is just a little piece of advice that could really, you know, sort of help landlords. And the other way is that there's a lot of fantastic landlords in Burlington who do a really great job, and we want to get their names out there and so people know that they do a great job and that they can get some business.
So leaving a negative comment can be a little bit tricky. So what advice do you have for the renters who want to leave some information about a landlord or property?
Well, we do have a page on our site that is guidelines for posting, and we also have guidelines for landlords that want to refute a review, which they're welcome to do. We invite people to post, if they're going to post any factual information, it must be the whole truth, because really it isn't helpful to anyone if the post isn't accurate. We're really committed to the integrity of the information on the site, and it doesn't, you know, it's not good for us to have information on the site that isn't true. We encourage people to post their opinion if they so desire, but it's a good idea to preface it with "in my opinion," because there are two sides to every story, and we certainly do recognize that. And remember that it's a public forum, and landlords are allowed to read and refute the reviews, so I wouldn't write anything that you wouldn't want your landlord to see.
Sure. And listeners, we'll have a link to BV Tenants on our website so you can check it out, and that's at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Alex Sturgis is the website's founder. Alex, I really appreciate you taking the time out to be on the show today.
Thanks so much, Nina.
1-800-639-2211, our number to call. Angela Zykowski and Pam Favreau, I'd like to get your quick opinions, and then we'll take some more calls. Pam, what do you think of that website? Have you gotten any feedback on it?
I've been asked this question, absolutely. And I think that anything that helps educate any tenant or any landlord towards their rights and responsibilities could be a good thing. Absolutely. At Vermont Tenants, we've been around since 1981. We opt not to do a section of our website, which is at cvoeo.org, by the way, to be able to post comments and reviews, because we truly understand that there are two sides to every story, and if we can't confirm it, we certainly don't want to potentially carry any liability for it, but mostly because we don't think that a kind of a public airing of differences between the landlord and tenant is going to have a little bit of potential to escalate the situation, and we really are an education program, and so we spend our time teaching tenants that this is not a casual thing. There are laws that basically oversee your rights, your responsibilities, as well as the landlord's. And we teach them to work within the laws when there are a problem. There are laws that help you get things fixed. If a landlord's going into your apartment with no notice, there's a law that can help you fix that. If they're not repairing things that you need done, there are laws that can help you fix that quickly and easily. So We teach the law. We teach these are the steps you take one after another to get this problem resolved.
Dave in Bridgewater wrote in, I'd like to remind all landlords to give their tenant a current landlord certificate form and to remind all tenants to bring the original form to their tax preparer so that they can apply for a Vermont renter rebate. All Vermont tax preparers, thank you. Pam Favreau, can you briefly explain what he's talking about?
Sure, I can. And it also gives me a good chance to say that that's not something that people should call our agency about. So basically, there's a tax credit allowed where, you know, the landlord is paying a property tax. And the tenant's rent is considered to be part of the money that the landlord's income that goes towards the payment of that property tax. So at tax time, landlords provide a certificate of what percentage of the tenant's rent payments went towards different areas. And a tenant's allowed to look for filing for a rebate on what they've paid when they file their taxes. We are a landlord-tenant law agency and experts. We're not tax experts. So when they call us, we refer them to the Department of Taxes.
And Nina, just to jump in here.
Sure, go ahead.
For the landlords out there, the tax department for the first time this year has made the landlord certificate, which is the form that landlords fill out and give to their tenants, available as a fillable PDF online.
Yeah.
Previously, this has only been available as a paper version. So it's out there. It's on our website, vtlandlord.com. If folks would like to go to our website to find the link to get this form, it is due by the end of the month. So landlords.
And listeners, we'll put up links to all the organizations that we've been mentioning on our website, vpr.net. Let's go to the phone lines. We've got a lot of folks waiting to talk right now. Let's go to Bethel and talk with Layla. Hi, Layla. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi, I've been on both sides of the spectrum. I've been a renter who has had to call the State Department because there were health violations in my building that weren't being addressed, and now I'm currently a landlord. And what I want to know is why is it so difficult, and I don't want to sound like an ogre, but when a family has children, you're told that you can't kick them out in the middle of winter. So I have seen people decide that they are not going to pay their rent, they can't afford it, and they just decide to stay where they're at because they know that their landlord can't kick them out until it's not winter anymore because they have children.
Yeah, that's one of those myths we had discussed earlier. You can evict tenants in the winter. You can be evicted with children, with disabilities, with a note from your doctor saying you're dying. You can be evicted at any time of year.
Angela Zykowski, how about that? Is there any more that you want to add to Layla's point that she's feeling as a landlord that it's really difficult? And I'm wondering, are there misconceptions out there for landlords?
I believe that this is one of those misconceptions. We will see as a part of the court process, which is where notice is head if the tenant doesn't leave voluntarily, we will see judges sort of slow down the issuances of writs of possession, which is ultimately what gives the landlord possession of their property back. Maybe right around Christmas, you know, they might delay it by a day or two, but it absolutely, you can evict tenants in the winter, as Pam said, whether they have children or not, whether they're disabled or not, whether they have some sort of health crisis or personal crisis. It doesn't matter. Any time of the year is fine.
All right. Well, let's take another call. Let's go to Burlington now and talk with Joe. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Afternoon, I should say. I'm a landlord in Burlington, and I have multiple units. I just heard two comments made that it's students looking for apartments and that it's students who cause the shortage of rental housing. And I'd say that here that oftentimes when people come look at my apartments, I don't rent to any students, not because I don't want to, because I don't need to. And I say to these people who ask me that question, I say, well, where do you come from? And many of these people are moving here from out of state. So Burlington is a great place to live, and people want to live here. And that's the reason that we have one of the primary reasons we have shortage for housing. It's not just because of students looking for housing. Thank you.
Got it, Joe. Let's take another call right now from Clay, who's calling from East Dummerston. Hi, Clay. You there, Clay?
No, this is Jamie.
Oh, hi, Jamie. Go ahead.
Yes, I can't believe, I really appreciate the show. Just real quick, about 8 weeks ago, my mother was involved in a fire in Newport, Vermont, and she was displaced by that fire. And I was able to secure her another affordable apartment in Newport, Vermont. And my question is, what are her rights now? I spent 45 hours of my own time rehabilitating the apartment for the landlord. And now that she's been there nearly 6 weeks, she has been without heat and hot water, and she's currently without heat and hot water. And I have tried numerous times to contact this landlord to rectify the situation. And, you know, I mean, with the weather we're having right now, she is sitting in an apartment at 50 degrees with mittens on. And I'm just wondering what agency can
Jamie, let me throw that question to my guests. Pam, okay. Favreau, you want to start?
Sure, I'd be happy to. This is what we do. So not wanting to take up the radio show all day, Jamie, I would say two things. One, call the town clerk's office where your mother lives right now. Ask for the name for their town health officer. Report it to that person. He's got the authority to go to the landlord immediately. And my experience is town health officers in this state are frequently volunteer positions with not a lot of training and support, and they're fabulous. They do they don't get thanked for what they do, but they're wonderful. That should be her very, very first step. And my guess is she'll find that she has heat very, very quickly. And the other is, please, ask her to call our hotline. It's 1-802-864-0099, or you can find the link on BPR's site, and I'd be happy to talk to her personally.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the relationship between landlords and renters today on Vermont Edition. You can join our conversation, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We had a listener write in with a comment about condominiums. Ruth writes, if I am renting out a room in a condominium which I both own and live in, are there differences in legal requirements as a landlord? And if so, what are they? Angela Zykowski, what would you say to that question?
Unfortunately or fortunately, there are no differences. Some of the notice time frames for asking a person to leave are shorter when a renter is residing in your personal residence, but it's the exact same process. It's sending a notice. If the person doesn't leave, it's going to court to go through a court eviction process. And with a condominium, there may be a separate layer over the top, which places limits on how many units can be rented out. So she may want to make sure she's not running afoul of any of her condominium association requirements.
Mm-hmm. And if I can jump in addition to any eviction requirements, You know, if I own my own home and I choose not to have carbon monoxide detectors or smoke detectors in the bedrooms, or, you know, it's kind of in disrepair, that's my choice, my risk, my business. But if I rent a room to somebody, I now have a rental property. And so this person who sent a message in needs to understand that the residence needs to be up to code.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it at that. We'll have to make that the last word. Listeners, this discussion will continue online. So if you have other comments or questions, feel free to post them. This discussion will keep going at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Angela Zykowski is the owner of the Vermont Apartment Owners Association. Pam Favreau is director of Vermont Tenants. Thank you very much, both of you, for being on the program today. I think we covered a lot of ground.
Thank you very much for having us.
It was great. Thank you.
Coming up, we'll talk with VPR News analyst Hamilton Davis about the many questions facing Vermont lawmakers as they grapple with funding health care. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kack. The issues with the state's health care exchange have been well scrutinized since its October launch, but the exchange is just a prelude to much more radical changes for health care delivery in Vermont. The governor pushed for and the legislature approved a law that sets Vermont on a path to a single-payer health care system in 2017. But there are open questions on how the state will create the financial foundation for that system. News analyst Hamilton Davis studies and writes about these issues for VPR.net. His article this week looks at a few major questions that lawmakers will need to resolve in the next year or two to keep the idea of a single-payer system alive. Hamilton Davis joins me now to explain further. Hi, Ham.
Hi. How are you, Nina?
I'm well, thank you. Now, the goal of a single-payer system for the state is to contain costs and provide universal health care coverage for Vermonters. But the central question of cost containment is really a tricky one. The current system has escalating costs that obviously aren't sustainable. So what will change under single-payer to bring those costs down?
Well, Nina, there are really two things. And the first, we've already begun with the Green Mountain Care Board exerting much more stringent control on Vermont hospital budgets. We'll see how that works going forward, but the regulation aspect of it seems to be working. But the central piece of the cost containment machinery will be an attempt to really rewire and change the whole way that the healthcare delivery system works. They will have to shift from a system which these doctors and hospitals tend to be separate and compete with one another to an integrated system in which doctors, hospitals, clinics cooperate with one another. In order to do that, you have to have them, number one, tied together, a computer system that will tie all the units of the Vermont system together. That's not easy, but it's just a matter of money and time and getting it done. The most difficult part is trying to change the way that doctors relate to one another so that they work together instead of working competitively. And the key element in that, the most difficult piece of that, is changing the way doctors get paid from fee-for-service, which encourages overuse, to some kind of per capita group-based system of financing that encourages cost containment rather than overuse.
And you're talking, though, about major changes in the way the doctor-patient relationship works, the way that doctors and hospitals work. It's a major upheaval. And I know that lawmakers wanted some assurance that that upheaval would be worthwhile. And you write in your recent article that the law that creates the single-payer system also includes several safeguards before the policy can move forward. And I'm wondering if you could explain what those provisions are.
Well, Act 48, which is the foundation for the single-payer initiative, sets out very specific conditions, six of them, that would have to be met before you would have a single-payer system. They really amount to one thing, which is that the legislators want to be sure that costs can be contained for a single-payer system year in and year out into the future. That's never been accomplished in the United States before, and I think they're right to do that. These were safety valves written as specific amendments by Senator Kevin Mullen of Rutland. They just make the implicit requirement that everybody understood that you had to have cost containment. Legislators want to be sure, for example, that if you put in a single-payer healthcare system, that there will be no negative economic impact on the state. Well, that's, you know, that's how do you prove that? How do you prove that out in the future? Very hard to do. But my view is, after talking with people about this for 2 or 3 years now, that the questions can all be answered if the legislators can be sure that the combination of regulation by the Green Mountain Care Board and the integration of the system and a shift to a different kind of reimbursement, if they can be sure that that will work, then I think they'll feel safe going ahead.
Given what Senator Mullen laid out in the law, is it possible to meet those individual thresholds and still provide single-payer coverage to Vermonters?
Sure, it's certainly possible to do it. The real question with the Mullen triggers is not whether they should be met, and they should, or whether they could be met, and they can. The real question in the current political environment is when they can be done. At the present time, the legislature and the administration are on a track to consider the $1.6 billion cost in the legislative session that begins next January in 2015. The problem with that, as far as I can see, is that there is no way, none whatsoever, that you can really provide real surety that this system will contain cost by 2015. You should be able to do it possibly by 2016, and you should have a really pretty good look at it by 2017. But getting it done by 2015 is impossible. What I think is possible, maybe possible, is simply for the legislature to wait on the financing decision until they can see that the cost containment system really works reliably well enough to go ahead. But I think that Governor Shumlin runs the risk of having his program take a terrible blow if the legislature votes no on the necessary financing. What he needs to do is to hold that back until he has his cost containment system up and running.
Even if we can bring down those healthcare costs that you were talking about, the funds that we're looking at to maintain health care coverage in Vermont are massive. At least $1.5 billion will be needed to, in part, pay for this system. For comparison's sake, that's more than the state spends on its general fund and transportation budgets. The more than $1.5 billion number comes from a study that Governor Peter Shumlin's office requested from a group at the University of Massachusetts. Hamilton Davis explains some of what that UMass report found.
The designers of the UMass program did their best to come up with the amount of money that you would have to add to Medicare and Medicaid in order to cover everybody in Vermont with decent health care insurance. The estimate they came up with was a little over 1.6, but they concede in the report that an operating system for a single payer has not yet been designed, so that you have to make a whole series of assumptions, and the fact of the matter is that the $1.6 billion is just an estimated guess. And it's really too early for anybody to figure out what the cost would be, but the political realities in the state today mean that you really don't have any choice but to try and figure that out. You just simply cannot talk to legislators about any kind of program without them asking how much does it cost. It's just impossible to do. So the Shumlin administration has come up with the UMass number, which is 1.6. The stakeholders, the doctors, hospitals, insurance companies, the business community, all of whom would be very significantly affected by a shift to single payer, have hired their own expert. They got their own estimate. That was like $1.9 to $2.2 billion.
So their numbers were even higher.
Their numbers were significantly higher, and that was the point. They hired a firm called Avalere Health, based in Washington, D.C., and what they really wanted them to do is to look at the UMass report and see if whether they agreed that the UMass estimates were realistic. They thought they were not. The reality is that neither UMass nor Avalere really know, because you can't see the system yet. So what those really indicate is not what the number actually is. None of these people is going to come up with the right number unless it's a huge accident. Its importance lies in what it tells about the political environment that this whole issue is generating. The stakeholders are really anxious. They are really unhappy about what the Shumlin administration is doing. The Shumlin administration has been tangled up and has got into a political mess and a public relations mess with the rollout of the exchange, which is really not an integral part of the original healthcare reform idea.
it's really bogged them down, and now we're just starting to assess all the number crunching, as you mentioned. You're right, Hamilton Davis, that creating a single-payer system and proving it will contain costs is a formidable task, even if lawmakers believe Governor Shumlin was the reincarnation of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his healthcare team was as skilled as NASA engineers. They don't believe that. So I think the big question many Vermonters are wondering is single-payer a realistic goal?
Well, everybody has to decide that for himself. I think it is, put it this way, Nina, what is critical here is whether you have a pure single payer or not. What's critical is that you have health care reform, that you get costs under control, and that you cover everybody. But that is not only possible, that is absolutely necessary for Vermont. The lesson of the last 40 years is that we simply cannot sustain the kind of health care system that we have now. It just costs way too much. It costs $1 in Vermont out of every $5 that Vermonters earn. It simply really can't go any higher than that. So you have to get those costs under control. And I think it can be done. I think it's worthwhile doing it. The question is, how quickly can you do it, and will it fit into the legislative schedule that's envisioned at this point?
VPR News analyst Hamilton Davis studies and writes about healthcare policy. His recent article on paying for a single-payer system is online at vpr.net. You can read the entire article and get a lot more detail. Ham, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Visit a local pond or ice rink, and you're most likely to see figure skates or hockey skates carving the ice. But people who want to skate far and fast over open ice on frozen lakes or rivers have another option: Nordic skates. Imagine cross-country ski boots fitted with long blades and detachable heels, and you'll get the idea. The sport has taken off this winter on Lake Maury, where a 4-mile path is cleared on the ice for Nordic skaters. We stopped by during a skate-a-thon last weekend, where experienced Nordic skaters were sharing their passion and newbies were testing their skills.
We can set you up with a pair of boots. What's your size?
9.
Hi, I'm Jamie Hess, and I'm a lifelong ice skating enthusiast. 15 years ago, I took my passion to new heights when I took a trip to Sweden in the middle of the winter to discover the best ice skating in the world. And I was so overwhelmed by how wonderful the skating was, the frozen lakes, the ice conditions, the people who were just so warm and welcoming and happy to take me on tours all over central Sweden. And then there were the ice skates, which I had never seen before. The Swedish-style ice skates are unlike anything that had ever existed here in the United States.
Reportedly good all the way down that side. So.
Carly Miles. This kind of skating, if you have those nice long-bladed skates, you can really cruise on them. Hockey skates are more built for turning and swerving like figure skates. So a little different kind of blades, a little different kind of sharpening techniques. So that guy's got the long blades and he can go fast.
My name is Russell Hirschler. I'm the executive director here at the Upper Valley Trails Alliance. We're here at the Lake Maury Skate-a-thon. This is our 12th year doing this event. And many years ago, people in this area, in this beautiful Lake Maury, had a vision of having a groomed skating trail, which this one here in particular is the longest one in the country, just over 4 miles. And this is a celebration of winter and ice.
My name's John Gukwa from Chelmsford, Massachusetts. And we came up to Lake Maury to visit some friends and to enjoy Vermont, which we love. The last time I skated probably when I was 14 years old. So it's been, more than 50 years since I've skated. And so I'm going to give it the old college try here.
Good luck, honey.
Okay, thank you.
I am Carter Coe from Georgia.
Bo Dixon from North Carolina.
Christine Dixon from North Carolina. Just here for the skate-a-thon. No. No, this is our first winter here. So we're enjoying the local activities. It's very different to be skating on a pond. It's not something you do in the South, so I drag them along. So we'll see who gets tired first.
Our audio postcard of the Nordic Skate-a-thon on Lake Maury in Fairleigh was produced by VPR's Charlotte Albright. You can find photographs at vpr.net. And that's Vermont Edition for today. Tomorrow, we'll look at large-scale solar energy installations in Vermont. How are those projects developed, and what are the pros and cons of big solar? Has your town had discussions about large-scale solar projects? Tell us about them, and tell us what you think of solar arrays that have been built near you. Write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and join us tomorrow. You can stay connected with Vermont Edition and all of VPR's news coverage through the VPR app. Download it to your iPhone or Android, and you'll have easy access to VPR's live stream, recent Vermont Edition programs, and VPR's digital news stream. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson and Devin Karambalis. Peter Biella directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potler and the Nocturnals. From PEG TV Studios in Rutland, I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.